Hello and welcome back to the Story Society podcast. Or if you're joining us for the first time today, then we welcome you with open but obviously socially distanced arms right now. As always, thank you for your continued support. The podcast has now reached 50 countries, 45 to 50 states. We are going for the whole 50. So you guys out there in the US that are listening, keep sharing to your friends. Keep passing on the good vibes about the podcast. We really do appreciate it. We do see all of your plays, interactions on the socials, and always welcome messages on Instagram and Twitter. So please, please get to us there at story_society on Twitter. And on Instagram, we are at storypoduk. So log on there. Let us know what you think of the podcast. Chat with us. Tell us what you want in future episodes. Suggest topics. Always, if you can, share, subscribe, and 5-star rate the podcast. It really does help out the show a lot. But enough of the social jargon. Let's get down to this week's episode. So, as always, join us as we tell you the story of the murder of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, the Soham murders. At 11:45 a.m. on Sunday, the 4th of August 2002, Jessica Chapman left her home in Brook Street, Soham, to attend a barbecue at the home of her best friend Holly Wells in nearby Red House Gardens. Prior to leaving her home, Chapman informed her parents of her intention to also give her friend a necklace, which was engraved with the letter H. She had purchased this for her on a recent family holiday to Menorca. The two girls and a friend named Natalie Parr played computer games and listened to music for around half an hour before Natalie returned home. By 3:15 p.m, both the girls had changed into Manchester United football shirts. Now, if you remember anything about this case, this is probably one of, if not the lasting image of this horrific case. These shirts become iconic and synonymous with the two girls because once they had changed into these shirts, which belonged to Holly and her older brother Oliver, at 5:04 p.m, the parents took a photograph of the two girls before they ate dinner with the other house guests. So this was to be the last photo of the two girls alive. They, after eating dinner with the other house guests, returned to playing in Holly's bedroom at approximately 6:10 p.m. Around about 6:15, the two girls left Holly's house without informing any of the guests to purchase sweets from a vending machine at the local sports centre. Whilst returning to 4 Red House Gardens, Holly and Jessica walked past the college close home of Ian Huntley. Ian Huntley was the senior caretaker at the local secondary school. Huntley had evidently lured the girls into his house, stating that his girlfriend Maxine Carr, who was the girls' teaching assistant at St Andrews Primary School, was also present in the house. Now, at the time, Carr was actually visiting her mother in Grimsby in Lincolnshire and was not present. The precise chain of events to occur after this, when the girls entered 5 College Close, is unknown, although investigators believe sections of Huntley's claims in an initial interview granted to the media prior to his arrest and later his trial testimony, such as that he had been cleaning his dog at the time the girls passed by his house at approximately 6:30 p.m. and that one girl had been suffering from a mild nosebleed, and may have actually been true. In any event, the cause of the death of both girls was later ruled to be asphyxiation. Jessica's Nokia mobile phone was switched off at 6:46. So there's a good chance that by 6:46 p.m, both of the girls had already died. At 8 p.m, Nicola Wells entered her daughter's bedroom to invite the girls to say goodbye to her house guests, only to discover that both the girls were missing. Alarmed, she and her husband Kevin searched the house, the nearby residences, streets. Minutes after their daughter's 8:30 p.m. curfew had expired, Nicola Wells phoned the Chapman residence to determine if the girls were at this location, only to learn that Leslie and Sharon Chapman were becoming concerned. Why? their daughter had not returned home. Following subsequent frantic efforts by the families of both girls to locate their daughters, Holly and Jessica were reported missing by their parents at 9:55 p.m. to police. Now, put yourself in these parents' shoes. I don't have children, but I can't even begin to imagine how horrific it must feel when your child goes missing. The anguish that they must have gone through from the beginning of this, you know, berating themselves about, why didn't I just check on them earlier? Why didn't we take them to go and get sweets if that's what they wanted? All of these simple things that could have helped this horrific tragedy not to happen. You know, it's tragic. It's very, very tragic. Even beginning to think of that makes me feel so uneasy. And I don't even have children. So for any of the parents that are out there listening, I'm sure you can imagine, if even if you've lost your child for 30 seconds and they've gone out of your sight, you know, feeling this way for hours on end and not knowing what's happening to your children must be awful. So at this point, obviously, like we said, they've contacted the police. Now, police immediately launched a very intensive manhunt to locate the two girls. At one point, they had over 400 officers assigned full time to search for them. Now, that is an impressive search, using a probably what would have been a very small police force at the time. These officers conducted house-to-house searches, inquiries across Soham. Their efforts to search local terrain were also helped by assistance of hundreds of thousands of local volunteers, terrified for the safety of these two girls, and later the US Air Force personnel stationed at nearby air bases. And to assist in their public appeals for information, Cambridgeshire Police released the photograph that we spoke about earlier, where Nicola Wells had taken a picture of the girls less than 2 hours before their disappearance, depicting both of the girls wearing those very, very distinctive deep red Manchester United football shirts. Now, even saying this to you, I can remember very much so the picture. It's the two girls, Holly and Jessica, underneath the clock. You can see what time it was. You can see what they were wearing. It's a very, very clear picture. And it's a very, very good picture to use because it's the most up-to-date picture they had. A physical description of each girl was also released to the media, describing both girls as being white, approximately 4'6" in height, and slim. Chapman was described as being tanned with shoulder-length brown hair. Wells was described as being fair with blonde hair. The parents of both girls were adamant their daughters had been wary of talking to strangers. They'd warned them not to trust people they didn't know early from childhood. So this whole situation was very, very out of character for the two girls. So immediately when this must have happened, the parents' hearts must have sank because they know this is not their two girls. They know they wouldn't just run off and not come home. So they had obviously spoken to them about this early in childhood. Like we said, it was supported by the head teacher of the primary school, who informed the reporters who were asking questions that the possible danger from strangers is something that was impressed upon the children from a very, very early age. So this all goes to reinforce that this would never happen. These kids aren't troubled kids. They don't run off at the sight of trouble or an argument at home. Nothing had happened. This was completely out of the blue. Now, probably suspecting that the girls had been kidnapped, investigators questioned every registered sex offender in Cambridgeshire and Lincolnshire, which is over 260 offenders across the UK, including 15 high-risk paedophiles. They were also questioned, although all were eliminated from the inquiry. And police also investigated the possibility that the girls had arranged to meet with an individual either or both of the girls had contacted via internet chat rooms, although this possibility was very, very early ruled out. Now, on the 8th of August, there was CCTV footage of the girls, which was recorded minutes before their supposed disappearance, and it was released to the public. Now, this footage showed the two girls arriving at the sports centre where they'd gone to get the sweets from the vending machine at around 6:28 p.m. A TV reconstruction of the girls' last movements was also broadcast nationally on the 10th of August, and both sets of parents granted an interview with presenter Colin Baker on ITV's Current Affairs programme Tonight. It was broadcast on the 12th of August. Other family members and friends of both girls also appealed via the media for the safe return of the children. There were so many appeals and so much wanting to find these girls safe, well and alive. I remember this very well. I remember coming home every day and asking my mum, have they been found yet? Have they been found yet? Constantly had Sky News on. Constantly looking 24 hours a day to see whether, you know, there was any news of these poor girls. It really was a story that gripped the nation. A lot of people remember this case. A lot of people remember those two girls' faces. The appeals for information regarding the whereabouts of Holly and Jessica would see more than 2,000 phone calls and tips received from the public, with all information obtained and entered into the investigation's Homes 2 database. A candlelit vigil was held by the community of Soham on the 7th of August. Shortly after the girls' disappearance, Staffordshire Police contacted their counterparts to report their suspicions that the girls' likely abduction may be linked to an abduction which had occurred in their jurisdiction the previous year, in which a six-year-old girl had survived an indecent assault by an abductor who was still at large and whose green Ford Mondeo was identified as having number plates which had earlier been stolen in Peterborough. The individual responsible for this abduction and assault was also believed to have followed a 12-year-old girl in the same area, although in this instance his car had been fitted with number plates which had been stolen in Nottinghamshire. The same vehicle had recently been sighted in Glatton, Cambridgeshire. This information was later included in the televised appeal pertaining to children's disappearance on BBC's Crime Watch. Now, although this was a potential lead, it ultimately failed to bear any relevance to the case. It may have been a significant line of inquiry at the time, at the very early days of this case. However, it was not to be going down that route, and that tip, although credible, was not relevant to the case of the missing girls. Now, as with many missing people's cases, particularly missing children, a lot of tips coming, a lot of sightings come in. Several members of the public reported in as having seen the children in the early days of the investigation. One particular person that had made such a report was a gentleman by the name of Mark Tuck, who informed investigators that he had driven past the girls when he was on Sand Street in Soham Town Centre at approximately 6:30 p.m. on the 4th of August. His attention had been drawn to Holly and Jessica because of the Man United replica shirts they were wearing, causing him to say to his wife, Lucy, "Look, there's two little Beckhams over there." Now, at the time, David Beckham was huge, absolutely huge, playing for Manchester United, one of the best footballers that England's ever seen. And so, quite rightly, the first thing you think of when you saw somebody in a Man United shirt was David Beckham. So, a young woman also named Karen Greenwood reported seeing the girls walking arm in arm along College Road approximately 2 minutes later. Another woman living in the nearby village of Little Thetford claimed to have seen the two girls, whose appearance and clothing matched those of Holly and Jessica, walking past their home the morning after the children had been reported missing. Police also received statements regarding a white van that had been seen in Soham on the evening of the children's disappearance. Investigators located and seized this vehicle from a caravan park in Wentworth on the 7th of August, although that lead ultimately proved fruitless and not relevant to the case. On the 12th of August, police launched a media appeal to trace a driver of a four-door dark green saloon car seen struggling with two girls by a taxi driver who stated he had observed this individual thrashing his arms as he struggled to either placate or contain two female children inside his vehicle as he had driven upon the A142 south of Soham towards Newmarket on the early evening of the 12th of August. The following evening, a jogger alerted police to two mounds of recently disturbed earth he had encountered at Warren Hill just outside Newmarket. The initial speculation by this individual had been that these mounds of earth may be the impromptu burial locations of the two missing girls. However, an overnight examination of that location revealed that these mounds of earth were simply no more than badger sets. So you can see the, you know, it's gripping the area itself, the local areas surrounding it, the entire nation were really honing in on this case, trying to find these two girls. And, you know, it just shows what can be done when everybody bands together and tries to find a result. One individual who claimed to have spoken with the girls immediately before their disappearance was 28-year-old Ian Huntley. Now, you may remember we mentioned his name earlier. Ian Huntley was the caretaker for school, and he informed investigators on the 5th of August he had engaged in a brief conversation with both girls on his doorstep the previous afternoon. So this is the day they disappeared. He had a conversation with both the girls. According to Ian Huntley, Holly and Jessica had briefly inquired as to whether his partner, Maxine Carr, had been successful in a recent application for a full-time teaching job at their school. When he had replied that Maxine had been unsuccessful, one of the girls had said, "Please tell her we're sorry," before both the girls had walked along College Street in the direction of a bridge leading towards Clay Street. Now, police were suspicious of Ian Huntley's account of the children's disappearance. His house was searched by a single police officer on the 5th of August. Although no incriminated evidence was discovered on this date, the officer noticed numerous items of clothing upon the washing line, despite the fact it had been raining, in reference to the evident extensive cleaning of the house's interior. Ian Huntley stated, "Excuse the dining room, we had a flood." This officer was unconvinced by Ian Huntley's claims and suspicious of his agitated demeanour, and he remained a strong suspect. Now, I'm certainly no police officer. I've never had police training. I've never had any kind of training to suspect people of any of these things. I have, however, delved into a lot of true crime cases, murders, and looked at a lot of transcripts of police interviews and watched a lot of police documentaries. And like I said to you earlier, I remember coming home every day, watching the news, seeing if the girls have been found, particularly on Sky News. Sky News were covering it. You know what they're like. 24 hours a day, there'd be something. They would find a reason to be on the air all the time. Now, I remember turning to my mum when this case was on and saying to her, when he was being interviewed, when Ian Huntley was being interviewed, and saying, "There's something really odd about this guy. Like, he just doesn't seem bothered. Like, he actually looks quite scared about talking about this." And when him and later Maxine Carr, who was also interviewed on Sky News, when they were talking about the girls in past tense, like they already knew what had happened to them, you know, saying that, well, they were lovely girls. Were implies they're no longer here to be lovely girls. And I looked at his demeanour, same as we're saying here, that the officer who'd been in to search his house said his agitated demeanour. And if you look back to those early interviews on Sky News, you can see exactly what that officer meant, because he was on camera to the nation lying, because he already knew what happened to these two girls. And it's scary, but in a lot of cases, the individual responsible inserts himself into the case to try and become not recognized as a suspect, to try and be the helper, the caring one, to divert the attention away from them. But ultimately what they do is insert themselves in it too far, to the point that people become suspicious. And that's effectively what had happened here. Now, one day later, on the 6th of August, Huntley drove from Soham to Grimsby to pick up Maxine Carr. Shortly before, returned to College Close, a neighbour of Maxine's mother, named Marion Clift, observed the couple standing by the rear of the vehicle with the boot open. According to Clift, a pale, shaking Huntley had simply gazed into the boot for several moments, whilst Maxine stood alongside him, her head bowed and weeping. When Ian Huntley became aware of Clift's presence, he had abruptly closed the boot. Now, like I said, Ian Huntley had been interviewed by Sky News, and particularly correspondent Jeremy Thompson, on the 15th of August 2002. And what I'd like to do is just play you that interview and let you listen to how Ian Huntley came across during this interview, and see what you make of how he sounded.
How do we know they were here at 6:15? Well, we have an eyewitness. Ian Huntley here is a familiar figure. Evening, Ian. You're the school caretaker. The girls, Jessica and Holly, would know you, and they saw you on the front doorstep. What went on?
Well, I don't know the girls. I stood on the front doorstep grooming my dog down. She'd run away and come back a bit of a mess. They just came across and asked how Miss Carr was, as she used to teach them at St Andrews. I just said she weren't very good, as she hadn't got the job. And they just said, please tell her that we're very sorry. And off they walked in the direction of the library over there.
Okay, so you can probably hear what I'm saying in his voice there, but what obviously I would want you to do is go and watch that video on video sharing platforms like YouTube, Dailymotion, all those other good ones, BitChute. Because you will see his demeanour, his body language, the way he was and how he was talking. And it would just make more sense to see it visually as well, I guess. But like I said, people like him insert themselves in the case. And in the weeks following the disappearance of the two girls, Ian Huntley reluctantly granted several TV interviews to media outlets such as Sky News and the regional BBC news programme BBC Look East, and was speaking of the general shock in the community and locally, and his apparent dismay at being possibly the last person to see the girls alive. In one interview granted to Sky News, Jeremy Thompson, during the second week of the search, he said to him that he had claimed to be holding on to a glimmer of hope that the girls would be found safe and well, claiming that he had last seen the girls walking in the direction of the local library. Now, having actively participated in the search for the girls, Huntley also made efforts to ingratiate police officers, regularly asking questions as to how the investigation was progressing and just how long DNA evidence could survive before being unusable, like deteriorating. Now, one of these officers observed three vertical scratches upon Huntley's left jaw, each measuring approximately 3 centimetres, which he claimed had been recently inflicted by his dog. Now, even just I'm laughing, but this is not a funny case whatsoever, but I'm laughing more in disbelief. How, as a callous, cowardly man that did this, are you going to have the audacity to stand there and ask police officers how long it will take for DNA evidence to deteriorate? Now, if that isn't the biggest fucking red flag for those police officers, what can be? He may as well have walked around with a flag himself going, I did it. And yet this investigation still went on. I get that you have to build a case against someone, but that is the point where you pull that man in and you grill him. And you grill him. Because that is just, a normal person doesn't ask that kind of question. A person that asks that kind of question is a person who's guilty. Maxine was also interviewed by the press during the second week of the search for the girls. In a live interview, Maxine corroborated Ian Huntley's claims to have conversed with the children on their doorstep as she had been bathing before both girls had walked away from their doorstep, adding, "I only wish we had asked them where they were going. If only we knew that then, obviously, what we know now, then we could have stopped them or done something about it." Discussing the individual personalities of each girl, Maxine Carr described Holly as being the more feminine of the two, adding that Jessica was more of a tomboy, and that on one occasion she had jokingly remarked to Jessica how, unlike many of her friends, she seldom wore a skirt. To this question, Maxine Carr stated that the child had expressed her desire to be a bridesmaid at her own future wedding, adding that Jessica had said she would willingly wear a dress for such an occasion. Maxine Carr also displayed a thank you card to the reporter, which had recently been given to her by Holly Wells on her last day of the school year. Referring to Holly in the past tense, Maxine Carr stated she was just lovely, really lovely, before making a direct appeal to the girls, just get on the phone and just come home, or if somebody's got them, just let them go. By the second week of the children's disappearance, Ian Huntley had begun to lose weight and vividly displayed symptoms of insomnia. To one officer, he begged the question, "You think I've done it? I was the last person to see them," before beginning to weep. His erratic and distressful behaviour led to his being prescribed antidepressants on the 13th of August. So this is a guy now who knows. He knows. He's the last person that saw the girls alive. He knows. He's under suspicion. He's being watched. He's starting to feel the effects of being that person and knowing what he's done. On the 16th of August, 12 days after the girls' disappearance, Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr were first questioned by police. Both were questioned for around 7 hours. Each provided formal witness statements to investigators before they were placed in a safe house in the village of Histon. By this date, police had received information from several Grimsby residents who had recognised Huntley in the television interviews he had granted to the media. These individuals recalled that he had been accused of rape several years earlier. Other individuals recalled that, contrary to her own televised claims, Maxine Carr had in fact been in Grimsby town centre on the night that the girls had disappeared and not at home in Soham, as she had stated in the interview she granted to the media. Now, the same evening that police were interviewing the pair, they were also conducting a very thorough search of both Five College Close, where they lived, and the grounds of Soham Village College, where Ian Huntley worked as a senior caretaker, as they remained under police watch at separate locations outside of Soham. And although each room of Huntley's home had evidently been recently and meticulously cleaned with what was later described as being a lemony cleaning fluid, these searches located numerous items declared as being of major importance to the ongoing investigation. Although the evidence and artifacts were not made public at the time, the items recovered from the school grounds included items of clothing that the girls had been wearing when they were last seen, including their charred and cut Manchester United shirts, which were recovered from a bin within a hangar at Ian Huntley's place of work. Fibres recovered upon these items of clothing proved to be a precise match to samples retrieved from Huntley's body and clothing, as well as from Five College Close. Furthermore, his fingerprints were recovered from the bin. Now, Huntley's car was also subjected to a very, very detailed examination on the 16th of August. The forensic examination of this vehicle revealed the car had also been recently extensively cleaned, although traces of a distinctive mixture of brick dust, chalk and concrete of precisely the same type used to pave the road leading to where the girls' bodies would be discovered were found around the wheel arches and upon and around the pedals. Furthermore, a cover from the rear seat was missing and the lining of the boot had recently been removed and replaced with an ill-fitting section of household carpet. Now, that looked, or what looks, or looked then, as someone definitely with something to hide. Now, You are the person that has access to all of these places. You're the person whose DNA is found in all of these places. And yes, some of it could have been found because he works there. However, when you have two missing girls and you now have the clothing they were last wearing in a place you have access to, and you were apparently the last person to see them alive, and your car has direct evidence on it linking the two girls to being in it, that's it. You're done. The case is done. It's just a case of proving it in a court of law, because there is nothing there that screams he is not guilty. From the minute we saw him on TV, I had a horrible suspicion that this was the guy that had helped these girls disappear. And when I say disappear, I mean that he had killed them. And that was horrific, a horrific thought, because the girls would have gone to him in confidence and trust, as he was a figure of trust at the school. And the fact that they would have gone in there unknowingly to their fate is awful. Now, having discovered the girls' clothes at the village college, police obviously decided that they were going to arrest Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr, as they had enough evidence to start building a case against them. And they obviously believed that they were two individuals that had perpetrated this crime. Now, both were arrested on suspicion of abduction and murder at 4:30 a.m. on the 17th of August. Although investigators had previously, on the 7th of August, publicly stated they strongly believed the girls had been abducted, they publicly announced their strong suspicions both girls had been murdered on this date. During initial questioning, Ian Huntley refused to answer questions and appeared evasive, confused, detached, occasionally drooling throughout police attempts to question him in an effort to feign symptoms of mental illness. This left police with no option but to initially refer Huntley to a mental hospital to undergo a psychological evaluation. Now, that's something which would be standard practice, as it will allow the police to rule out whether this is someone using a tactic to try and avoid sentencing in prison and to be going to a mental health hospital instead. Now, by contrast, Maxine Carr quickly confessed to detectives that she had lied about her whereabouts and her partner's actions on the 4th of August, as shortly before she had returned to Soham from Grimsby 3 days later, Ian Huntley had admitted to her in a phone call to have seen the two girls shortly before their disappearance, admitting, "The thing is, Maxine, they came in our house." Now, according to Maxine Carr, Ian Huntley then informed her the children had entered the house in order that Holly Wells could stanch her nosebleed. He then claimed to her Chapman had sat upon their bed as he had helped Wells control the bleeding from her nose before both of the girls had left their house, referencing one of the 1998 rapes he had committed but had earlier claimed to have been falsely accused of in his phone call. Ian Huntley then began voicing concerns as to, again, being falsely accused of his involvement on this occasion, also claiming his previous arrest had caused him to suffer a breakdown. She had obviously therefore agreed to create a false story with him to support his version of events. Now, after being informed of the discovery of the girls' bodies and the evidence attesting to Ian Huntley's guilt, including his fingerprints being recovered from the bin in which the girls' clothes had been found, Maxine Carr burst into tears, shouting, "No, he can't have been. It can't have been. He hasn't done it." Despite these revelations, Maxine Carr initially remained emotionally attached to Ian Huntley and professed her belief in his innocence to both the police and her family. Now, part of that is probably an intense amount of shock. Like I said, it was a very high-profile case. She knew when she was lying for a reason, but I don't think, well, I mean, I don't know, maybe she did. I don't think she knew the extent of the reason she was lying. Because you've got to think, he had suckered her in, he had a relationship with her. The relationship they had would then have become nothing. To invest all of your time in a person and then to have something like this happen would be a shock to the system. You do stupid things when you're in love. You do say things to people that maybe aren't accurate to try and save face. And I am not excusing what she did at all, because there was parents out there desperately searching for children who deserved an answer. And she should have given that answer early doors, when she knew he had seen the girls and when she had seen what was in the boot. Because I believe at that point she knew. She knew, and she should have said. But she was in shock and she didn't. And it's shit, because she should have. But unfortunately she didn't. And she let the parents and the friends and local community suffer waiting for news of these two girls. Now, the news that Holly and Jessica's parents, family, friends, community, and the entire nation had been dreading came at around 12:30 p.m. on the 17th of August, when 48-year-old gamekeeper Keith Pryor discovered the bodies of both of the girls laying side by side in a 5-foot-deep irrigation ditch close to a pheasant pen near the perimeter fence of RAF Lakenheath in Suffolk, a location more than 10 miles east of Soham. Pryor had noticed what he later described as an unusual and unpleasant smell in the vicinity several days earlier. When returning to the area with two friends on the 17th of August, he had decided to investigate the cause of this odour. Now, walking through an overgrown verge approximately 600 yards from the partially tarmac road, Pryor and one of his companions, Adrian Lawrence, discovered the girls' bodies. Immediately upon viewing the bodies, Lawrence turned in the direction of his girlfriend, Helen Sawyer, and shouted, "Don't come any closer, Helen, get back in the van." He immediately reported the discoveries to the police. Now, I can completely understand why he did that. You wouldn't want anyone else witnessing what you had just witnessed, because it was probably horrific. You know, this is so long now after the girls had disappeared, and obviously knowing that he'd burnt their clothes, you know, you can imagine what kind of state, unfortunately, the girls were in, because they had obviously decomposed. They would have been in an advanced state of decomposition. The girls have been missing for around 13 days at the point their bodies were found. So it's obviously not going to be a great thing to see, and something that would scar you for life, I would imagine. In an apparent effort also to destroy evidence, you know, the girls' bodies had been attempted to be burned. So I feel sorry, very, very sorry for the two gentlemen that had to make this discovery. However, for the parents and the community and family, and it will provide closure, although it's not the closure that obviously any of them would have wanted. In addition, no clear footprints were discovered at the crime scene. Obviously, it's, you know, 2 weeks after they were taken there, and, you know, rain and other such weather events would have disturbed the scene too much to collect anything from there. But despite the attempts to destroy evidence and try and stop the identification, investigators rapidly deduced that the two victims were in fact the girls and had not died at the location of their discovery. Numerous hairs later determined to belong to Chapman were also discovered on a tree branch close to the location of the girls' bodies. The following day, a Cambridgeshire deputy chief constable named Keith Hodder released a press statement to the media confirming the discovery of the girls' bodies, adding that both families had been informed of the developments and that although positive formal identification would take several days, investigators were as certain as they possibly could be that the bodies were those of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. on 21st of August, the bodies of both girls were conclusively identified via DNA testing. 9 days later, a public memorial service was held at Ely Cathedral to remember and celebrate the lives of both of the girls. This service was attended by approximately 2,000 people, including the girls' classmates, teachers, and the six family liaison officers who had provided 24-hour service for both families. The Reverend Tim Alban Jones officiated the service, informing all present would not the best and last in memory to these two lovely young girls be a change for the better in how we behave towards each other. Today's service is a small milestone in our shared journey of grief and sorrow. It is our hope that maybe we perhaps draw a line under one phase of our grieving and begin to look forward. An online book of condolence attracted more than 31,000 messages of grief and sympathy, and on 24th of August, football clubs across Britain held a minute's silence prior to commencing scheduled football matches. So this is what I'm saying. It was a huge case. It drew attention from everywhere, every section of the media. When appeals were going out from numerous members of the family, friends, you know, it even got the attention, obviously, of Manchester United, because the girls were wearing their Manchester United shirts. It even evoked the emotion in David Beckham to make an appeal on behalf of the families for the safe return of the two girls. And this was a huge outpouring of love and remembrance at this service. And I distinctly remember it being covered on the news. I remember the horrific moment when I was told what happened to the two girls. It is one of those cases that you will remember, particularly in Britain. I'm not sure of the appeal worldwide. I'm not sure how far it reached. This was still back in the days where the internet was in its infancy. We didn't have a news source in our pocket 24/7. You didn't have phone tracking apps, any of the such like things that we have now that would possibly help prevent this crime before it even got there. It's sad, because had any of this technology been around then, I believe that these girls would be alive today. And just such a waste of young life, such a waste. And like I said earlier, to be perpetrated by someone that they trusted is just unimaginable. Obviously, after the girls were discovered and identified and all the proper protocols were done and we, you know, have had the service, obviously after that, we start looking to the case and the inquest. Now, the formal inquest into the girls' deaths was held at Shire Hall, Cambridge, on the 23rd of August 2002. At this hearing, Coroner David Morris testified the bodies of both girls were partially skeletonised and that no precise cause of death could be determined for either Polly or Jessica. Although Morris stated that the most likely cause of death of both girls had been asphyxiation. Furthermore, Morris stated that the girls had almost certainly not died at the location where their bodies had been discovered, and that both bodies had been placed at this location within 24 hours of their deaths. These conclusions were physically supported by an analysis of the shoots and nettles located at the crime scene, which enabled forensic ecologist and paleontologist Patricia Wiltshire to approximate that the actual time the bodies had been placed at this location had been almost 2 weeks prior. Now, by the 20th of August, investigators had established sufficient physical evidence from Ian Huntley's home, car and Soham Village College to formally charge him with two counts of murder. He was formally charged with these offences whilst detained for observation at Rampton Secure Hospital, and all preliminary hearings against him were postponed until the conclusions of the previous mental health assessment that I mentioned before. Maxine Carr was also charged with attempting to pervert the course of justice on this date. She was further charged with two counts of assisting an offender on the 17th of January 2003. While on remand At Holloway Prison, Maxine Carr regularly inquired as to Huntley's welfare and is known to have penned several letters in which she professed her continued love for him. Maxine Carr would only sever all contact with Huntley in December 2002. Now, as for the previously mentioned mental health assessment of Ian Huntley, he was detained under Section 48 of the Mental Health Act for almost 2 months at Rampton's Cure Hospital. It was here that his mental state was extensively assessed by Dr. Christopher Clark, who is a consultant forensic psychiatrist, to determine whether he was suffering or had suffered from any form of mental illness and whether he was mentally competent to stand trial. Clark concluded in October that although psychopathic, Huntley did not suffer from any major mental or psychotic illness. Resultingly, on the 8th of October, Huntley was deemed mentally competent to stand trial. Although Ian Huntley made clear attempts to appear insane, I have no doubt that the man currently and at the time of the murders was both physically and mentally sound, and therefore, if he is found guilty, carried out the murders totally aware of his actions. And that was a statement from Dr. Christopher Clark on his conclusion of the assessment of Ian Huntley's mental state. So this is a guy who clearly knew what he was doing. And like he said, was clearly psychotic to have carried out such a horrific crime on two young girls, but didn't do it because he was mentally ill, did it because he's an evil bastard, pretty much is what he's saying, but in a nicer and more appropriate form than the way I've perhaps just described it. But having been declared mentally fit to stand trial, Huntley was then faced with a sentence of life imprisonment if a jury would be convinced of his guilt. He was transferred to a segregation unit at Woodhill Prison in Milton Keynes in Buckinghamshire. On 9th of June 2003, he attempted suicide by consuming 29 antidepressants, which he had accumulated in his cell. Although staff initially feared Huntley might die as a result of his overdose, he was returned to his prison cell within 48 hours. And he was later transferred to London's Belmarsh Prison. At a preliminary hearing held at the Old Bailey on the 16th of June 2003, Ian Huntley pleaded not guilty to the formal charges of murdering Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, although he chose to plead guilty to the charge both stood accused of, which was conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. Maxine Carr pleaded not guilty to the charges of attempting to pervert the course of justice and assisting an offender. The trial of Ian Huntley for the murders of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman opened at the Old Bailey on the 5th of November 2003 before Justice Alan Moses. Huntley was charged with two counts of murder, to which he entered a formal plea of not guilty. Maxine Carr was charged with two counts of assisting an offender and one count of perverting the course of justice. In his opening statement on behalf of the Crown, Prosecutor Richard Latham QC described the last day of the friends' lives and how by pure chance they had happened to pass by Huntley's home at a time when Carr was not present. Latham contended Huntley had deliberately lured the girls into his home at approximately 6:37 p.m. and that both girls had been murdered shortly thereafter, with cell site analysis proving Huntley had switched off Chapman's mobile phone either outside his home or within the grounds of Soham Village College after both girls had been murdered. Latham further emphasised that mobile phone records and eyewitness accounts prove Carr had been in Grimsby on the evening in question, thus proving the statements she had given to police and press alike had been false. Latham then outlined the details of how Keith Pryor and his two friends had discovered the children's bodies on the 17th of August at a location Huntley had known to be restricted via his plane spotting hobby and thus where they were unlikely to be discovered. Referencing the likely motive for the girls' murder and the actual cause of death for each of the girls, Latham stated that due to the extensive state of decomposition of the bodies, the coroner had been unable to determine the precise cause of death of either of the girls, or whether the girls had been sexually assaulted before or after death. However, Latham stated neither body showed signs of compressive neck injuries, knife wounds, drugging or poisoning, and that both girls had most likely died of asphyxiation. In a direct reference to Huntley's claims both girls' deaths have been accidental, Latham stated that only one person knows what happened after the friends entered his home. However, he further stressed that the cause of death was undoubtedly murder, adding 10-year-old girls don't just drop dead. In reference to Carr's attempts to pervert the course of justice, Latham stated that as surely as night follows day, the two had conspired to concoct a false alibi to divert suspicion from Ian Huntley, although he warned the jury Maxine Carr could only be convicted of assisting an offender if they believed she had known Huntley had murdered the girls, adding her actual motive for providing lies to police with reference to the charge of perverting the course of justice was irrelevant. Over the course of 3 days, Latham outlined the efforts of both defendants to divert suspicion, away from Huntley, and Huntley's own efforts to destroy all of the physical and circumstantial evidence linking him to the crime. Although despite these efforts, investigators had retrieved enough evidence to prove the children had been murdered within his home and within approximately 12 hours of their deaths, transported in his vehicle to the location where the bodies would be discovered on the 17th of August. This had included fibre evidence retrieved from Huntley's vehicle, clothes and carpets, which had been a precise match to the Manchester United shirts the girls had been wearing at the time of their disappearance. Latham had then closed his opening statement by again bringing the jury's attention to Huntley's claim that both deaths had been accidental, remarking, "We pose this question. Two of them?" He then speculated Huntley's defence counsel may try and argue that he had been confused, commenting, "In that case, they would have to consider Ian Huntley's behaviour over the fortnight between the girls' disappearance and their bodies being found." Testimony pertaining to the forensic evidence linking Huntley was heard on the 24th November. On this day, a forensic scientist named Helen Davey testified as to the biological evidence recovered from the girls' clothing, their footwear and a dishcloth discovered within the hangar at Soham Village College on the 16th of August. David testified that she found minute traces of blood and saliva upon these garments. Although she had found no positive traces of semen upon the clothing, she further explained the reason for the lack of any definitive traces of semen being discovered could have been as a result of the charred and melted condition of the article she had inspected. A scenes of crime officer also testified on this date that despite Ian Huntley's exhaustive efforts to remove any physical evidence of his crime from his home, a forensic examination had revealed several traces of blood splattering about the hallway and main entrance to the master bedroom. On the 1st of December, Huntley testified before the court in his own defence. He was responding to questioning by his own defence counsel, Stephen Coward, QC. Huntley admitted both girls had died in his house but denied that either death had been intentional. According to Huntley, he, Wells and Chapman had entered his bathroom to stem a mild nosebleed Wells had been suffering from when the girls had walked by his home. The bath was already filled with water as he had been cleaning his dog that afternoon. In the bathroom, he had slipped and accidentally knocked Wells into his bath while helping to stop her nosebleed. And this unintentional act had caused her to drown as he himself had simply panicked and froze. He further claimed that Chapman had witnessed this accident and began repeatedly screaming, "You pushed her." And that he had then accidentally suffocated her while attempting to stifle her screaming, which had preoccupied his attention as opposed to ensuring Wells did not drown. By the time his state of panic had waned, it had been too late to save the lives of either of the children, and that his first coherent memory had been of himself sitting on his vomit-stained landing close to Chapman's body. When he was questioned as to his apparent failure to call emergency services and subsequent extensive efforts to destroy evidence and divert suspicion from himself, Huntley insisted he had first become preoccupied whether the police and public alike would believe the girls' deaths had actually been accidental, and he had therefore decided to conceal all evidence of the deaths as opposed to either notifying police or paramedics. Crying, Huntley admitted responsibility for both deaths but repeated his insistence that both deaths had been accidental, and he further tearfully claimed he had not attempted to feign insanity upon his arrest. insisting the trauma of the girls' deaths had temporarily erased his memory and his being in the presence of police had caused his mind to temporarily seize. I mean, what a load of shit. Sorry. I mean, I know I should be impartial doing this, but you lured the girls in. I feel like, allegedly, you lured the girls in. You'd been pissed off about something that had happened that day. Lured them in. Suffocate them both. Just because you could. And then hid all the evidence. That's what I feel like had happened. But, obviously, as they said, only one person will ever know the answer to that. On the 3rd of December, Maxine Carr took the stand to testify in her own defence, responding to questioning from her own defence counsel, Michael Hubbard QC. Carr briefly discussed her initial acquaintance with Huntley, their subsequent relationship and plans to start a family once they both obtained financial stability, before Hubbard then directed his questions towards her return to Soham on the 6th of August and her discovering Huntley had recently washed their bedding and had evidently cleaned sections of the house. To these questions, Maxine Carr explained that her first impression had been that Ian Huntley had probably had a woman in the house, adding that their bedding had been washed shortly before 4th of August. Maxine Carr further testified to having noted a crack in the enamel of the bathtub, which had not been there when she had travelled to Grimsby 4 days previously. When questioned as to why she had then assisted Huntley in extensively cleaning their home in the days following the children's murder, Carr claimed she had done so as she had always been obsessive about tidiness. Questioned as to her efforts she had subsequently made to mislead both police and the media to divert suspicion from her partner, Maxine emphasised that she had only lied to police, the media and anyone who asked to protect Huntley, who had been repeatedly assured her of his innocence of any wrongdoing and his fear of being fitted up, as he called it, by police for the girl's disappearance should they discover the 1998 rape allegation he had already had made against him. She further claimed to have referred to Wells and Chapman using past tense merely because she had worked with the children in the past. Carr further claimed she had attempted to persuade Huntley to contact police and be open as to his claims to have invited the children into his home in order that Wells could stop her nosebleed, but that he had refused to do so as inviting children into his home could be a violation of the rules imposed by St Andrew's Primary School that they both attended. She further explained her focus had therefore been to protect Huntley's job and reputation, adding that she had known of Huntley's actual guilt, she would never have attempted to provide him with a false alibi, stating to her counsel, "If for a minute I had known or believed he murdered either of the girls, I would have been horrified." Concluding his questioning, Hubbard cautioned the jury not to succumb to the temptation of judging Carr's morality, but to consider her state of mind prior to her arrest when considering whether the lies she had told warranted any criminal liability, stating that she had done no wrong on the date of the children's murder and had not returned to Soham until the 6th of August. In the closing arguments on the 10th of December, counsels for both prosecution and defence delivered their closing arguments to the jury. Latham delivered his closing argument on behalf of the prosecution by describing both Huntley and Carr as accomplished liars. Before outlining the prosecution's case, both children had to die to satisfy Ian Huntley's selfish self-interest before Huntley, with Carr's support, had embarked on 12 days of cynical deception, with Carr only revealing the truth about her lies to police after being informed of the discovery of the children's bodies. Referencing Huntley's likely motive for the murders and his claims at trial that both deaths had been accidental, Latham stated, "We invite you to reject the accounts of both deaths being accidental as desperate lies, the only way out for him. We suggest that this whole business in the house was motivated by something sexual, but whatever he initiated plainly went wrong. Therefore, in this ruthless man's mind, both girls had to die in his own selfish self-interest." Referencing Carr's conscious efforts to deceive the police and media alike, Latham simply stated she had the prospect of marriage, a baby, a nice home and a new start. She preferred to do what she could to make the best of the position she was in. That involved at all costs protecting Ian Huntley. Following the conclusion of the prosecution's closing argument, Coward delivered his argument on behalf of the defence. He conceded his client was indeed guilty of physical responsibility for the girl's actual deaths, as Huntley had admitted, and therefore deserved punishment, although he argued the prosecution had failed to provide definitive proof Huntley had intended to murder the children or cause them actual bodily harm. Furthermore, Coward intended the prosecution had failed to provide conclusive evidence to support their claim that Huntley's actual motive for the murders had been sexual. Coward concluded his closing argument by requesting the jury deliver a verdict of manslaughter in relation to both deaths. Now, to read you a section of Judge Alamose's formal sentencing of Ian Huntley on the 17th of December 2003. He said, "Your tears have never been for them, only for yourself. In your attempts to escape responsibility, in your lies and manipulation, you have increased the suffering of two families. There is no greater task for the criminal justice system than to protect the vulnerable. There are few worse crimes than the murder of these two young girls." Following the conclusion of both counsel's closing argument, Judge Moses announced the jury would begin their deliberations on the 12th of December. The jury deliberated, and they did so for 4 days, before reaching their verdicts on both defendants. On the 17th of December 2003, they returned a majority verdict of guilty on two counts of murder against Ian Huntley. He was subsequently sentenced to life imprisonment, with a minimum term of imprisonment to be imposed by the Lord Chief Justice at a later date. Huntley's face displayed no emotion as the verdict was announced, although the mothers of both Wells and Chapman burst into tears. Although Carr willingly pleaded guilty to the charge of perverting the course of justice, she pleaded not guilty to the charge of assisting an offender. The jury accepted Carr's insistence that she had only lied to police and media in order to protect Huntley, because prior to their arrest she had actually believed his claims of innocence. As such, she was found not guilty of assisting an offender, and Maxine Carr was sentenced to serve 3.5 years in prison for perverting the course of justice. Shortly after the convictions, the parents of both girls granted an interview to the waiting media. Discussing Huntley's mindset, Leslie Chapman stated, "I think he was a time bomb waiting to go off, and both our girls were in the wrong place at the wrong time. I hope the next time I see him, it will be like we saw our daughters, and it will be in a coffin." Now, if that doesn't sum up just how much someone can hate another person, I really don't know what can, and who can blame him. This man took his daughter away, took his daughter's friend away, and then tried to conceal the fact. And there is not a person, parent, living human being that would not understand the anguish pouring out of this man at this point, and the emotion of finally knowing that the man that's responsible for this, and the woman who's responsible for protecting the man who's responsible for this, is now behind bars and being punished as he rightfully should. Now, what was Huntley's actual motive for killing the children? It's never really come to light. It's still relatively unknown, although it is now known minutes prior to encountering Holly and Jessica, he is known to have had a heated argument with Maxine Carr, culminating in his slamming the phone down. Now, that fit of rage could have caused anything to go off in his mind, and Huntley had allegedly suspected Carr of conducting affairs throughout their relationship, leading both his mother and some police officers to suspect Huntley had killed the two girls in a fit of jealous rage. However, prior to his trial, a criminal profile had resulted in this being ruled out by an eminent criminal psychologist as a latent predatory paedophile who had chosen to lure Wells and Chapman into his home upon a moment of opportunism. The prosecution had contended at Huntley's trial that a likely sexual motive existed for the murders. Testimony from Carr had indicated her suspicion sexual activity had occurred in their home in her absence, as although Huntley had insisted throughout the entirety of the relationship that Carr perform all the domestic chores, she had observed that he had washed the quilts, pillowcases and sheets of their bed in her absence. However, pathological evidence retrieved from the bodies indicating at least one of the girls had been subjected to a sexual assault either before or after her murder was not disclosed to the jury at Huntley's trial. The reason for this decision had been that both bodies were too extensively decomposed and damaged by fire to enable a conclusive determination of either the actual cause of death or if either girl had been subjected to a sexual assault. Although prosecutors at Huntley's trial contended he had intentionally lured the children into the house with a likely sexual motivation, investigators found no conclusive evidence of premeditation in relation to the murders. However, at the September 2005 hearing, in which the minimum term Huntley should serve before any form of parole eligibility was decided, Justice Alan Moses stated there is a likelihood of sexual motivation, but there was no concrete evidence of sexual activity and it remains no more than a likelihood. I don't know. The more I think about this, I think Leslie Chapman was right in what he said. He was a ticking time bomb. He had an argument with his girlfriend on the phone. In a fit of rage, it's possible for someone to do anything to another person. If you already have a violent nature, a past that would include attempted rape, sexual violence in general towards women, which it was established he had, it would indicate that all you would need is a spark to a flame. And he exhibited all those behaviours on that day. He had the argument with Carr. He lured the two girls in to see Maxine, thinking she was there. He then killed the girls. How he killed them will be up for debate, because he's probably never going to release the truth and will never want to admit to himself or to the wider public that it's true, because obviously he's already hated and would like to get out someday, which is never going to happen. But he was a ticking time bomb, and that argument that day caused that reaction in his brain to get the girls in the house, kill them, likely do what he wanted to them. Of course, we can only say that allegedly because we don't know. And then immediately knew he had to cover it up and panicked, did all the things that a person guilty would do, tried to remove all evidence that he thought would be found. And based on his past, which he'd already discussed with Carr, concocted a story with her to try and divert attention away from himself and her, and did everything possible to deceive the public, deceive the police, deceive the media that he spoke to on several occasions, and to prevent two families from knowing what happened to their beloved daughters is just something that is unimaginable. To even put yourself in those parents' position, how would you ever be able to come to terms with that? I get chills just thinking about it, and my heart goes out to them, seriously, because I don't know how you could cope with that. You're very, very strong people, and if you ever do hear this, which is probably highly unlikely, but if you do, then I salute both of your families, because it is astonishing what both of them did to prevent this being found out, and it's unimaginable pain. Unimaginable pain. So, as I said a few moments ago, Ian Huntley had a very, very shady past. Prior to murdering Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, Ian Huntley had established somewhat of an extensive record of consensual and unconsensual sexual activity with females, many of whom had been beneath the legal age of consent. He would typically use guile and or force to achieve his desires. And between 1992 and 2002, so over a 10-year span, he had committed numerous acts of physical and sexual violence against women and children, for which he had been legally unpunished. The youngest girl Huntley is known to have raped had been 12 years old, with another girl he had attempted to rape being 11 years old. So this is a man who is sadistically evil. This isn't a one-off thing that happened. This is a man who lives that lifestyle, who preys on innocent young girls. And that's why, although Justice Alan Moses said there's a likelihood of sexual motivation, if I'm honest, I have no doubt in my mind that unfortunately these girls suffered something similar. And the moments before they died must have been horrific for them. And I hate thinking about that. And I hate that people that know them, that may end up listening to this, hear people thinking that way about the two girls, because it must be truly awful. But unfortunately, knowing his history, it's a distinct possibility that that was the case. And following his arrest for the murders of Holly and Jessica, several former girlfriends of his stepped forward and stated that although Huntley presented himself to be charming and considerate as an individual in the early stages of a relationship, he would then become domineering and violent upon having established a sense of control. So this is a guy who really, you know, gets a kick out of power and being stronger than somebody. And as an adult male, you couldn't be stronger more than over a young, innocent girl. Or two, in this case, two young, innocent girls. He would become controlling over his partners, severely restricted and supervised any contact that they had with family or acquaintances. And he would also emotionally blackmail his partner if he saw any signs of them developing a resistance to his methods of control or indicating a desire to leave the relationship. So you now have him with paedophile tendencies, controlling and abusive behaviour, both physical and mental. And according to one columnist, the fact that Ian Huntley had remained unpunished for these often blatant and continuous acts had embellished Huntley's confidence and reinforced his domineering, misogynistic mindset, in addition to fueling his recidivism. Now, it's true. Many people that go down similar paths to Ian Huntley's, if they have behaviours that they can get away with and believe are okay because they're allowed to get away with it for so long, they develop a godlike complex. They start to believe, I'm never going to get caught, I can't get caught, this won't happen to me, this is how I'm living my life and no one's going to stop me. And up until this point, he'd been very, very successful at it. He had 10 years of practice of getting to this stage. So for him to be pleading in court that this was an accident, this was no accident, this was premeditated. He knew exactly what he was doing when he lured those two girls into their house under the false pretense that Maxine Carr was inside. And what he did with them after that doesn't bear thinking about. But definitely at no point in that day was it on a whim he saw them and thought, yeah. He knew exactly the moment he saw them, he was going to dominate them, lie to them, control them, and ultimately end up killing them. And it's sad to think that had he have been punished earlier for any of these crimes that he had committed, he would not have been on the streets to commit this crime upon Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. And more so, interestingly, because he worked at a school, he would not have been able to get a job as a caretaker of a school because he would have had a criminal record that involved abuse and sexual abuse on minors. And it's terrible that he didn't get convicted of any of these crimes sooner, because right now those girls would be living their life. They would be adults themselves, probably with children themselves now. And to have two families have to have that ripped away from them so cruelly and so quickly and so coldly in a calculating manner, it just seems so unfair. So unfair in life that that would happen. So as I said earlier in the episode, it's a case that struck a chord with me. It's a case that I remember very, very well, because around the time this happened, I would have been about 19 years old, and I remember talking to my family about it on a daily basis and praying that these girls would be found alive. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. And we spoke extensively in our household about this case because it received so much coverage. And there's a lot of families that would probably be feeling the same way that I do when talking about this story. Just immense sadness that these two wonderful young girls were taken well before they should have been from this earth. And for our listeners around the world that are listening to this, all different people, all different countries, if you aren't familiar with the case, then just do a bit of digging on YouTube, BitChute, Dailymotion, the search engines. You'll dig up some very interesting information on the case, and you'll see some of the interviews that we were talking about, and just try and immerse yourself in it, because you will find a lot of information out there, perhaps something that we didn't cover, or perhaps a different take on it rather than the way that we've done it today. But you will get just a smidge of the coverage that we received here in Britain at the time this was going on. This was so high profile and so sad, and it really united the country in grief for these two beautiful young girls. And as unfortunate as what happened, it's obviously the reason why we're talking today. So do your research, find out things about the case, and let us know what you found, and if there's anything else you want us to update you on. We mentioned the socials at the beginning of the episode, but please feel free to contact us. Even if this has affected you in a certain way, we can put you in touch with people. And all that's left to be said is, I'm your host, Tasha Gregory, and until the next story.